do not think about tomorrow. Let tomorrow come and go. Tonight you've got a nice warm boxcar, safe from all this wind and snow.
Hello, welcome to a special edition of Generation Justice, broadcasting from the University of New Mexico, KUNM 89.9 FM, where news and music connect. I'm your host for this evening, Roberta Rael.
And I'm your co-host, Omar Torres. Generation Justice is a multimedia project that trains youth to create media committed to inspiring social change.
In recent weeks, Albuquerque has received international attention, exemplifying a national crisis of excessive police force, as a police video went viral of the Albuquerque Police Department, APD, shooting of James Boyd, a 38-year-old homeless man who suffered from mental illness. As citizens took to the streets to protest this killing and others, the rest of the world took notice.
APD's practice of shoot-to-kill and excessive force has been of concern for many years. So tonight on Generation Justice, we bring you an in-depth view of the history of police militarization and the decline of mental health services that have contributed to the crisis we find ourselves in today.
We're joined this evening by David Correa, a journalist, UNM assistant professor, and author of Properties of Violence, Law and Land Grant Struggle in Northern New Mexico, who will give us a history of police violence and the militarization of police forces. Also, New Mexico State Senator Jerry Ortiz-Pino, columnist, longtime social worker, former director of the Protective Services Division for CYFD, and also former executive director of New Mexico Advocates for Children and Families. Senator Ortiz-Pino will help us to understand the impact of the decline of mental health services in New Mexico.
Then, in the second half of our program, we will hear from three different local activists on what citizens can do to help forge needed change. Joining us in that discussion is Sue Skirman, coordinator at the Center for Peace and Justice, Gloria Rebar of ANSWER, Act Now, Stop War and End Racism, and WORD, Women Organized to Resist and Defend. Also, Kenneth Guy Ellis II, the father of Kenneth Guy Ellis III, who was an Iraq war veteran who was gunned down by APD in January 2010.
Please stay tuned.
I know the police cause you trouble. They cause trouble everywhere. But when you die and go to heaven, you'll find no policeman there.
That was Hobo's Lullaby by Woody Guthrie, and helps us to lead into the discussion of the history of police violence. I'd like to welcome our two first guests to this discussion. David Correa, journalist, author, and professor who has specialized in the practices of police departments and looking at police brutality. And State Senator Jerry Ortiz-Pino, writer, long-term advocate for children and families in New Mexico, who started his career as a social worker. I want to welcome the two of you to Generation Justice.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Welcome.
David, we would like to start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about your work on police brutality?
Sure. I sort of came to this, as you mentioned in the introduction, through my academic work. The book I read, which came out last year, Properties of Violence, began as an academic study that I didn't really anticipate would have anything to do with police violence when I began it. It's a history of New Mexico land grant struggle. It's a story about New Mexico's colonial past. And, you know, I knew going in that when you're talking about New Mexico's colonial history, you're talking about violence. But what I didn't realize was the sort of contemporary and more recent expressions of that struggle, particularly in northern New Mexico, often find their form in struggles with police. And so one of the chapters I have focuses specifically on struggles around police brutality in San Miguel County and in Riobamba County. And in those instances, I think some really really sophisticated, really well-organized activists recognized police violence as a political fact of life. And so they organized through the political arena. And so La Raza Unida, as a sort of a Chicano third party, emerges in New Mexico, particularly in San Miguel County, really in many counties of the state. But in San Miguel and Riobamba, they organized themselves around protecting particularly Chicano youth from police who were really exploiting them, brutalizing them. In fact, La Raza Unida Party in San Miguel County had what they called a violence committee. And the violence committee's job was to surveil the police to protect young people in that community. And often, really, what would happen in this is in the 70s, by the way. This is not so long ago. The sheriff's posse, right, would be these sort of allies to the police. And, you know, they would take advantage of this sort of like shadow position. And they would really there was a lot of sort of violent conflicts between people. And this was also true in Rio Riba County. Pretty, I think, courageous activists like Ike de Vargas, Pedro Archuleta, if any of our listeners have ever heard of them, still around, still waging the righteous fight, recognized police violence as part of a way to reinforce a political institution that benefited the few at the expense of the many. And the few were the rich and the many were the poor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is my background academically. And then, you know, it was really no longer to me an academic exercise. It wasn't just a story I was telling in a book that was being published by an academic press when I'm seeing people being gunned down in the streets of Albuquerque by police. And so that's how I got involved in writing about police violence. I've been writing about police violence in Albuquerque since 2011. And I've been writing, most of that has been through I co-edited an online newsletter called La Jicarita, which I think maybe we'll put that up on the website later. And we've been covering this issue for 3 years now. And what I think that the important point, the thing I really recognized coming into this, the research I did on Albuquerque police violence, and I think what we have to, I think all of our commentators are going to mention this, is that this is nothing new. Mm-hmm. Right. Just like there were struggles in the 60s and 70s in Rio Riba County and in San Miguel County, so too has there been these struggles in Albuquerque. And in the 70s, group like the Black Berets were really organized specifically around police brutality in Chicano communities. They were inspired by Che Guevara and organized around sort of a similar style to the Black Panthers. And so they saw themselves as community servants trying to interrupt this pattern. But if we actually look at the pattern of police violence in Albuquerque, we have to start there, right? And we can go back further. And I have students working on this. We're really trying to piece together this history of APD. But where we start right now is in the 70s. And you know, there's been a lot of talk lately. Mayor Barry, who's been stonewalling efforts to reform APD, is now suddenly the reform guy. And I think it's important to point out there was a spike of police shootings and police killings in the 80s, and a series of reforms to training occurred. And then between 87 and 97, 31 people were killed by police in Albuquerque. And one of the key reforms that resulted after that bloody decade was the Police Oversight Commission and the Independent Review Officer. And those were reforms that APD promised us would really resolve these issues. And then APD promptly killed 23 people in the next 6 years after the Police Oversight Commission was created. The Police Oversight Commission can only make recommendations to the chief of police, and all those recommendations have always been rejected. The independent review officer, likewise, can only make recommendations for disciplining officers, and all of those recommendations have been rejected. Many of the reforms, for example, in this current pattern of violence that we find ourselves in, have been reforms that have been in place. They were in place before James Boyd was killed. They were in place before Alfred Redwine was killed. I think we need to recognize that. The kind of reform that some people in power in Albuquerque want is not the kind of reform that's going to make a difference in this pattern of violence. It has never made a difference before. And in fact, in a lot of these struggles that have resulted in reforms, it's actually those reforms then that become the issues that we're working to resolve later. So I think if we're going to really focus on, if we're going to focus on these last 4 years, Let's also remember that it's only a reiteration of a pattern that's 2, 3, 4 decades long.
So, David, I want to come back to you in just a little bit as you're talking about reforms, but I would like to bring in Senator Ortiz Pino. And Senator, if you don't mind, would you also give us a history of the decline of mental health services, and then I kind of want to bring this discussion together.
Sure. Roberta, the issue with the homeless and the mentally ill and services for them really dates back in the most striking way to the early 1980s when there was a whole national wave of deinstitutionalization, of closing psychiatric facilities, state-run psychiatric facilities, public facilities. That's where the impoverished, behaviorally ill used to get treated. Mm-hmm. For decades, they had been able to go to asylums and get treated. Whether that was great treatment or not is almost beside the point. They weren't wandering the streets. They were in an asylum. Mm-hmm. There were some horrible asylums. There were some people that got helped by it. But when the use of psychotropic medications began in earnest in the late 60s and 70s, these are these very strong antipsychotic medications, it became possible to turn loose people who had been in psychiatric hospitals for many decades. And they then were supposed to be served in the community. The problem is that once they were out of the psychiatric hospital, they may have stopped taking those medicines that made it possible for them to leave. In some instances, the psychiatric hospitals were just closed, and then people were sent out right and left. And we went through a period where there were really no services for them. The promise of community-based services wasn't kept. We saved the money. In fact, what happened is that we've reinstitutionalized them. We now use the jails and the prisons as the new institutions for the impoverished, behaviorally ill. If you've got money or insurance, you can find a psychiatric hospital somewhere. In the 90s, in Albuquerque, there were 7 psychiatric hospitals. There was Vista Sandia, there was Charter, there was Memorial, there was Presbyterian, Anna Caseman, there was Desert Hills, it went on and on and on. There were 7 because there was a way to pay for them. Mm-hmm. Medicaid was paying for them. But then Medicaid said, whoa, and that was a decade in which we didn't have a lot of people wandering the streets because they could go and get admitted to a psychiatric hospital if they voluntarily wanted to. Then when Medicaid said, well, we're spending too much money on these hospitals and so on, we're going to change the focus from the heavy end, the inpatient, to the light end, outpatient, and we're going to shift our money to managed care. That's when all those hospitals closed. Now we have only UNM, and I think there is one psych unit at Anna Caseman. And that's it in this community. We simply have shriveled the resources and not substituted the community-based services. We fooled them once, and now we fooled them a second time. Now there are a lot of people wandering the streets in need of services who can't get them because we haven't provided a way to pay for them. What we do have are jails. And that's the biggest psychiatric facility in the state right now is the Metropolitan Detention Center in Albuquerque. Mm-hmm. And those 200 people that are in that facility ought to be worked with by Medicaid so that the day they walk out the door, they can continue getting some kind of services. But if we don't, we're going to have more and more James Boyds confronted by police who have no real skill at training and dealing with them.
So still looking at a historical perspective, at the time that all of the decrease of mental health services was happening, I'm curious, was there an increase? What was the change in pattern in police departments and police forces?
Well, I think that if let's focus on Albuquerque for a minute, I think, and I think it might be useful to point out that whereas in the 70s, particularly the early 70s, when La Raza Unida was organizing in the North and the Black Berets were organizing in Albuquerque against police brutality, that police violence was largely racialized. Young Chicano men, particularly Native men, particularly if we're talking about border towns like Farmington and Gallup and moving outside of Albuquerque, this was racialized violence between the police and often young men. And what we see now, particularly after what this sort of transformation that Senator Ortiz Pino just mentioned, is that violence also is linked to homelessness and mental illness. So we're still talking about racialized violence against the poor. Now we have to also talk about that violence often being against the mentally ill and often against the homeless. And so it's no accident that many of the 23 young men that were killed by police over the last 4 years suffered from some form of mental illness, including PTSD, right? And we're not getting the treatment they needed. And also, let's point out, too, that the things that Mayor Berry is pointing out, like crisis intervention trainings and having more crisis intervention training officers in the field, those things have been in place. And, for example, Alan Gomez was gunned down by police. He had a crisis intervention officer, and that officer was not even called and brought to the site, right? The police department had a crisis intervention team they could have called to bring to the to the James Boyd standoff, and they chose not to bring them, even though, by the way, they told us they had originally, and that was a lie. So these things are correlated, and what happens then is that one of the things that there are more people being killed by police since that happened, right? That we still have that racialized violence, and now we've added the violence that the homeless and those that suffer from mental illness are experiencing.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that what we see going on right now, I'm afraid, is going to be an attempt to shift the public's awareness and focus from police violence onto the behavior of the mentally ill and how difficult they are to deal with. And we see this with the Albuquerque Journal and an editorial saying, what we need to deal with this is Kendra's Law. Well, Kendra's Law, which we've looked at several times in the state legislature, which some other states have tried various versions of it, Kendra's Law basically is a mandatory treatment. Whether you want it or not, if you run afoul of the police or a judge or somebody who decides you need treatment, you are forced to get the treatment, whether you like it or not, whether the side effects have terrible consequences for you or not. And if you don't, you go to jail. That's ultimately what we'll see happen. That is, if we impose a Kendra's Law here and shift the focus from the way the police treat the mentally ill to the way the mentally ill should be forced to get some kind of treatment, then I think what we're going to see is many more people going to jail, and in fact, many more confrontations between police and men and women who don't want to necessarily get into treatment, but who are being forced to go to jail or get treatment. And that's just going to up the ante.
So, Jerry, I'm going to go back to history. So prior to the 80s and early 80s, before some of the decline started to happen with mental health services, the role of police and people who suffered from mental illness, as I remember it, was that police would maybe find somebody on the streets, but they would take them over to the Bernalillo County Mental Health Center. And there wasn't an arrest, but they would get them into treatment. I'm not understanding why Kendra's Law would be different.
We don't have a place for them to take them.
Got it.
I mean, if we have resources, if there were places that they could go and be housed and there was somebody willing to pay for it, then that would work. But when we start closing those institutions and those hospitals, and when we don't replace them with community-based services, you know, it doesn't have to be a hospital. We used to have a very effective network in this community of drop-in centers and of outreach teams that would go to where people were and would just talk to them there and visit with them and try to, you know, engage them in a conversation and try to find out what was really going on. They weren't policemen. They were mental health workers and social workers. That's an approach we've abandoned, and instead we turn it over to the cops. They're not particularly skilled at it, and they only have two tools: lock them up or take them to an inpatient facility, where if they're not dangerous to themselves or others, they won't take them.
Exactly. Now I understand. Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So this is a question for both of you. What do you feel is the overarching problem? What is the overarching, I guess, the theme as to why everything's happening this way?
Right. So we have to start by saying that the problem is they're killing people, right? And then the next question is, why are they killing people? And I think that we have to focus on two things. We have to recognize that there's something uniquely wrong with the Albuquerque Police Department, and there's all kinds of possible solutions to that, and come out to the city council to meeting tomorrow, where we're going to be talking about demands and changes. And those demands and those changes focus on what I think answer your question, which is it's about something uniquely wrong with APD that helps explain why this is generations long, this pattern of violence. But there's also the other part, which is what we've been talking about, what Senator Ortiz Pino has been talking about, which is that we criminalize homelessness and mental illness, that people who are homeless and mentally ill in our community don't have a right to the city. You know, when James Boyd walked up to the foothills to go to sleep that night, he laid his head down just like all of us did. But when he did it, it was a crime. And so we have to create a city where that doesn't happen, where people can actually can live a safe life. Right. And how do we do that? Well, there are real ways to do that, right? We can demand that we decriminalize homelessness and mental illness. The police enforce laws that make it almost inevitable that they will bring weapons to confrontations with the homeless and the mentally ill, whether it's because of complaints of vagrancy or loitering or suspicious behavior, which is often the thing that brings them to these things, we can transform that. So, I mean, as a scholar, of law, my interest in law is that, you know, law requires coercion to make it lawful. And coercion just doesn't imply violence. It requires violence. Yeah. So it matters what kind of laws we make for ourselves, right? Because we're talking about punishing people that don't adhere to that, right? And so if you're criminalizing homelessness, if you're criminalizing the mentally ill, you're automatically saying those people are going to be in pain. Are they going to find themselves eventually experiencing pain because they're violating the law by virtue of who they are? So we've got to change those laws. So there's structural issues, but there are also, I mean, really profound reforms, and they're not the reforms that are being talked about in City Hall. They're really profound ones, and I think others here today are going to talk about that.
One of the big things to me is that underlies this is the fact that we're willing to spend money on jail and prison. A fraction of that money would be what it would take to provide alternative services, but we don't do that because we would rather blame than serve, and that's the heart of it. Mm-hmm. If we, instead of trying to find out who's wrong and who's not acting the way we want them to act and then punishing them for that, the way he was talking about criminalizing homelessness, and instead used a fraction of that money to provide services, we could solve this problem very quickly.
And when we, you know, and when we organize our community that way, what we end up having is these sort of absolutely insane priorities that are reflected in our budget. And so let me just point out that the city has paid out, I think it's about $26 million in court and out-of-court settlements based on police brutality cases, right? Let's just point out that that's more than the entire budget for parks and recreation for the city of Albuquerque in 1 year.
Repeat the amount, please.
So it's about $26 million. That the city of Albuquerque is paying out in court and out-of-court settlements based on suits of police brutality. That amount is more than an entire year's budget for the Parks and Recreation Department, right?
Wow.
So that's the kind of, that's what we've committed ourselves
right.
to, right?
Well, I want to thank both of you for helping us to get a deeper understanding of the history. Thank you, Senator Ortiz Pino and David Correa, for helping us to gain this historical analysis of the increase of police violence and the decrease of mental health services and how the two continue to collide and we continue to be in a crisis.
Yeah, I want to say thank you as well. I feel like this is really important because on social media and stuff like that, everybody makes comments, and I feel like a lot of times people make ignorant comments because they're not aware of the history and they're not aware of all the problems. So I just want to say that I appreciate you informing us on these things because I feel like it's really important because most people do not know and they just feel like, Senator Ortiz Pino was saying, we're focusing on the mentally ill and them as a problem instead of saying, no, the problem is how APD is acting and how they are. So I just thank you.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So next, we're going to introduce a song by the name of James Boyd by a local artist, Wake Self, and he wrote the song in honor of his passing.
Not too far to serve and protect the people. Isn't that really your job? Come on, James Boyd. I know you weren't perfect. You had a tough past. Grab your bags, turned around, got shot in the back. They say you deserved it. If he was a repeat offender, then it should have been known he was mentally ill. A couple of cops with guns, a homeless man with two knives that evens the...
Now, we want to bring in our next three guests into this discussion. Joining us is Sue Skirman from the Center for Peace and Justice, Gloria Rebar of Answer Coalition New Mexico and WORD, and Kenneth Guy Ellis II, who successfully sued the City of Albuquerque and APD for $10.3 million for the wrongful death of his son, Kenneth Guy Ellis III, who was fatally shot by APD in 2010. Welcome to Generation Welcome. Justice.
Thank you.
Kenneth, can we start with you first? Can you tell us about your son?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I guess I could start with 9/11 and when they flew the planes into our buildings. My son got very upset about that and decided to put his welding career on hold and join the military and go fight for his country and fight for freedom and liberty. And went over there and was in five different IED explosions, and the fifth one blew his battle buddy up all over him. So he came back from Iraq with severe post-traumatic stress disorder and was in the VA program and got kicked out of that program. And 3 days later, he was gunned down by Albuquerque police at the corner of Eubank and Constitution here in town. And that set me on my path to finding out exactly why someone with post-traumatic stress was gunned down and not helped. And here we are today with you know, the police violence and the history of our police being militarized. There's been you know, history's repeating itself. We've been through this before in the city. Back they had the Walker Luna report where it you know, explained what was going on, what was wrong with our police department, and then we had a perf report when the mayor took over in 2010. They had also a transition report. So there's been reports and reports after reports about this, and here we are repeating ourselves. I mean, at some point in time, we really need to, you know, do an effective a change here. We actually need, you know, community-based policing. We actually need civilian oversight of the police department. It's obvious that the police cannot police themselves. You know, it's just a sad state that we're in with our law enforcement. You know, we have good officers that are leaving the police department because of the immoralities that they're having to face within their units and their police departments. So, you know, the bottom line is the buck stops with the mayor, and he's had opportunity to take this bull by the horn, and he's not done that. He's you know, in order to fix a problem, you first have to admit that you have one. And until recently, he hasn't admitted that he's got a problem here. So, I mean, that James Void video was very, very disturbing. And what's more disturbing is that I know that there's, you know, a couple of dozen other videos out there that are just like that, that they refuse to release. We have these Freedom of Information Act, and we can do these IPRAs and request these videos, and they're not releasing them. They will not. They will rather pay a lawsuit than release the videos of these young men and getting killed on the streets of our city.
Kenneth, could you give us sort of an overview of what is police standard operating procedures? Like, what are they?
Well, basically that's abbreviated by SOPs, and basically that's the rules and the guidelines for the police on how they are to engage individuals. They have what's called the Code of Color Law that, you know, it's, at this point it's not worth the paper that it's written on, and that's a sad thing. You know, they have rules of engagement that they're not following. They have a whole tool belt full of tools, you know, tasers and mace and billy clubs and all these other, you know, like I say, a tool belt full of tools, and first thing they do is go for their deadly, for their gun and their deadly force, and it just doesn't need to be that way. I mean, it was brought to my attention that we treat animals that come out of the sandias better than we treat the James Boyds of our community. So, you know, we really need to reevaluate how our police engage our citizens in our community.
I'm happy with any of our guests answering this question, but it seems like part of the maybe informal operating procedures for APD is one that is really based in fear, where police officers are made to think that their life is always at risk. And I read a report off of the Albuquerque Journal that was, I believe, from 2012 when Chief Schultz was still the chief. And so he talked about how the new cadets, before they take their oath, they would actually take them over to a site where two police officers had been gunned down by a gentleman by the name of Mr. Hyde, who had a schizophrenic break, and they take the cadets to that site of the murder, of the killing of the two police officers, before they have the cadets do their oath. So it kind of, I don't know, it made me wonder, like, what is that about in terms of this operating procedure, and how does a police force that is based in fear serve and protect? So would anybody like to talk about that?
Well, yeah, I could talk about it. What we're doing here is we're taking these gentlemen that want to become law enforcement officers, and they want to do it because they want to serve and protect, and for noble reasons, you know, they want to help people. And we're putting them in a training that's paramilitary, where they train to shoot twice center mass and a third shot in the head. So they're taking these gentlemen, and they're training them to kill, and that's the wrong type of training. My daughter, right after they killed her brother, my son, my daughter Mary Jonelle Ellis, introduced legislation and turned it into a bill, and then ultimately Susana Martinez signed it into law, where they have to have de-escalation and crisis intervention training. It's mandatory. So we're on the right steps. We just need to retrain our officers, and we have officers, frankly, that shouldn't be officers. They're they need to be psychologically evaluated. They need to be, you know, tested for drugs and see about their post-traumatic stress and see where their disposition is. So we're in a critical stage right here, and we got a unique opportunity to really set an example for the rest of the country. And I really hope that our leadership and the mayor and our servants will step up here and create some laws and some ordinances and some training that can really, really profoundly impact how our law enforcement engage our citizens. Like I say, we have a unique opportunity, and I hope that the powers that will be will capitalize on this opportunity.
Thank you so much. David, did you want to respond?
Yeah, I think that's an important question about how the police engage with people. And let me briefly just say that, you know, the day after, the night of the protest Sunday ago, when the police came out with tanks and unmounted patrols and with truncheons and riot gear and military equipment and AK-47s, I think many people asked that same question. How did they make these decisions? Why did they come out like that? And the day after, the Deputy Chief Page contacted a local lawyer that works with activist groups and asked to meet. And I was a part of that meeting, and I wrote about it on La Jicarita. And we asked those questions: How do you make these choices about coming out this way? Who makes the orders to fire tear gas? How is engagement with the community organized? And they not only would they refuse to answer those questions, but they talked about how. I mean, quotes like, how much violence are we supposed to put up with, right? These are the kinds of questions they ask. Now, whether that comes from fear, I don't know. But I think it's a particularly militarized approach to engagement, in which they see themselves first and foremost as protecting themselves at all cost, and people that they encounter as threats always. And that was essentially what they were telling us in this meeting. That the community is a kind of threat, and we couldn't get answers to those kinds of questions. That's a difficult one to figure out.
They talked about what we can do and what we are doing, and I was just wondering, this is for Sue, what are local activist groups doing?
Well, we recently had a really large community forum at the Peace and Justice Center at Harvard and Silver, a block south from UNM, and we had to turn people away. We had 160 people in the room, and we had to turn 10 to 15 people away, which shows you how engaged people are. That video of James Boyd's murder by a seeming military force was a turning point. I think it's going to turn out to be a watershed moment in the history of Albuquerque. That was a team of soldiers attacking that man, you know, who is mentally ill. So people have said enough is enough. And like I was talking earlier, better late than never. There's been a dedicated small group working on this issue for years, and now the community is on board, and they are so engaged. I'm getting inundated with phone calls, messages by my personal email, my work email, Facebook messaging. It's a bit overwhelming, actually, but there's so much going on. People are hearing about things, and they're contacting the Peace Center and saying, hey, how can I get involved? Obviously, tomorrow is a really big evening, the City Council meeting. Monday night at, it starts at 5, but we're encouraging people to go down at 4 p.m. to sign up. If you want to speak during public comment, you get 2 minutes, and everyone is welcome to do that. And then I know there's going to be more protests organized, and I know we're also talking about later this month at the Peace Center, we're going to start holding workshops on how to be more effective at protesting. Some of the younger protesters who have never been out in the street before are actually looking to the elders who have been in the streets before about better tactics. And so those kind of conversations are happening. But, you know, we all just want to feel safe in our community. That's really what it's all about. Everyone deserves to feel safe. APD is obviously out of control, and they've created a climate of fear and intimidation. And we want new stewardship of APD where everyone can feel safe.
Absolutely.
Gloria, from Answer and Word, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. So what are some of the things that Answer Coalition New Mexico is planning?
Right now, the big plan is the city council meeting on Monday. We are working along with Sue, along with Mike, David, on other actions. We are working in solidarity. I agree with all of these guys that APD has created its own culture of violence in this city. And they're seeing the reaction from the people of the community. What Answer would like is for people to get involved any way you can. You can reach us, get your pen and paper ready, at 268-2488. And our email address is abq@answercoalition.org. So please give us a call. We basically have a message saying progressive change comes from independent actions and independent struggles. All of us have been to more city council meetings than we'd like to remember. It was not until the protesting began that we started to see some reforms. So we must keep it up, keep it organized. Anyone out there wanting to get a rally going or an event going, please contact the Answer Coalition or Sue at the Peace and Justice Center. Either one of us will be able to guide you in the correct direction.
Yeah, I was just going to follow up and say, you know, the Peace Center can act as a hub, you know, for information mm-hmm. about events, meetings, how to get involved. And like the Answer Coalition is a member of the Peace Center. So, and I you know, so is SWAP, you know, and SWAP has been very helpful with framing messaging. And so we can act as a hub for information. If you have information, drop it off. If you're looking for information, come on by. We're open Monday through Friday, through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. We're at 202 Harvard Southeast on the corner with Silver. You can't miss us. We have a huge, colorful mural that SWAT painted.
Thank you so much.
I just want to go back to Senator Ortiz-Cipino. I saw you had your hand up for comment.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up two quick points. One, there's been suggestion made that the level of violence escalated greatly by the police once there was an effort made to increase their numbers. And that was under a previous administration. There was an all-out effort to hire more police. And to get there, because police can retire after 20 years, the turnover is very great. So they had to hire an awful lot of people to get it up to 1,100 or 1,200, whatever their goal was. And the suggestion's been made that they lowered the standards and started recruiting people that maybe have been dropped from other police departments or didn't really pass the screening tests all that well, but they needed the numbers, so they hired them. If that's the case, that's clearly something that ought to be addressed. and that would immensely change the game. The second thing is there really has been for a long time in APD, and I guess in many police departments across the country, a culture of we have to protect ourselves against them. It's really not serving the public, it's protecting ourselves from the public. And that seems to be a mindset that can only be changed by leadership. And you can't change that culture by having demonstrations. Somebody in a position of authority is going to have to say no. And the way to change that would be to find some police officers who are guilty of excessive force or excessive violence to be guilty and to put the lesson out there that we will not tolerate this. Once that happens, the culture will change, but it would only take somebody in a leadership position to do that. If they're not willing to do that, we're beating our heads against a wall.
Okay. Kenneth Ellis.
Yes, I'd like to add to Senator Ortiz-Pino's comment in saying that DOJ is here, and DOJ is investigating this police department. DOJ has a unique opportunity to set an example out of these back shooting, murdering police that we have, and set an example for the rest of the country. DOJ needs to do the right thing. We've been waiting and waiting and waiting, and there needs to be some indictments and there needs to be some examples set. Some of these officers need to be indicted and given due process, the due process that my son and James Boyd were not allowed.
Hmm. Okay. Sue, I know that in the gatherings that have been facilitated in this collective over at the Center for Peace and Justice, there were some requests or demands that have come from the community. Are you able to share those?
Sure. The Albuquerque Task Force on Public Safety had come up with 14 demands, and then at our community forum, we added to those, and they've been recently combined, and they'll be passed out tomorrow. On a piece of paper we've got, it's like 2 pages long of demands, including what kind of police department we want, what kind of police oversight commission we want. The original 3 key demands were to dismiss charges on the protesters who were arrested on Sunday, March 30th, that we want all officers involved in the shootings to be indicted, and we want all the video from these shootings released immediately. But we also want city council to pass a law to make it mandatory for all officers to wear video cameras and to release that publicly within 72 hours of an incident. And I wanted to bring up that there is another way to do this. And there's an example of that in Rialto, California. It was mandatory for them to wear video cameras, and it changed them 180 degrees. And I actually, just for the heck of it, I went to their website. And they have a mission statement that includes the words courtesy and compassion. And I was just shocked by that because it's so hard for me to imagine our APD under Mayor Barry, Chief Eden, and CAO Rob Perry to be okay with using the words courtesy and compassion in how they deal with the community. But I think they've forgotten that they serve the public, and we are the public, and we need to be served with dignity.
So, again, next steps. And Gloria, I know you had your hand up you wanted to say something. So with regard to next steps, there's the city council meeting tomorrow. There's articles that David is writing on.
Everyone check out The Alibi on Wednesday. I have a cover story about James Boyd.
Okay.
There's also a police oversight commission meeting on Thursday. I believe it's at 10 a.m., but I'm not for sure, so you can...
No, that's...
It's at 4. Mm-hmm. It's at 4. Mm-hmm. And you can always go to our website. We have a web calendar, abqpeaceandjustice.org, and there's an extensive web calendar there. You can also call us at 268-9557.
Okay. Please get involved.
And so I just, with that comment, Ken... You're also connected to other families that have also been victims of police fatalities. So would you like to say anything about that before we...
Yes, I am. You know, it's kind of... I look back and see that hindsight is not only 2020, it's seeing God's work. And I've had these other fathers that have lost sons brought into my life, and we've all, you know, Mike Gomez and Stefan Torres and Earl Mitchell, and they all lost their sons, and each one of their sons was shot in the back. And that's something that has bothered me from the get-go, is how do you justify shooting someone in the back? James Boyd was turned around on his way down on the ground, and he got shot in the back. So, you know, I have a lot of, you know, like Mr. Torres said, we're all part of a family that now that no one wants to be a part of. And unfortunately, he's exactly correct. There's a lot of us out there that, you know, it's just not numbers. These are lives. These are families. These are whole, you know, several hundreds of people that have been, you know, affected by the killing of these individuals. And it's just a tragedy, that's beyond description. It's just very upsetting to me to see the state of our police and the state that this militarized police department is very, very discouraging to me.
Gloria, I know that you have something to say.
At one rally we had in 2010, it was after Ken's son was shot, after Stephen Torres, his son was shot, after Alan Gomez was shot, ANSWER got together and said, we need an emergency rally. It was at that time that we met the Gomez family. And from that point onward, we have been privileged to work with the families. What we want is some accountability.
Absolutely.
To this whole issue.
Bottom line.
Somebody has to be held accountable for murder.
That badge is not a shield against the law. They need to be held accountable to the laws that they're sworn to uphold.
No one's above the law.
Thank you very much.
So, who deserves to be safe in our community?
Everyone.
Each and every one of us.
All of us.
Okay.
Our community is terrified of our police department. I've literally talked to thousands of people on the street, and we as a community are terrified with the police and how they treat us. It's just you have to earn respect. You have to show respect in order to get respect, and that doesn't happen. This police department has literally brutalized this community.
But the people can turn it around.
Absolutely. Get involved.
Okay. So on Generation Justice's website, we will have contact information for all of our guests that are with us this evening. We will also have information about some of the next steps that have been shared this evening. And unfortunately,
we've come to the end of our show. But we want to give thanks to everybody that made this show possible. Longtime children and family advocate and New Mexico State Senator Jerry Ortiz Pino and David Correa, journalist and author. Thank you for being here.
We also want to thank Sue Skirman, coordinator at the Center for Peace and Justice, Gloria from Answer New Mexico and Word, and to you, Kenneth Alice II, for taking the time to be with us this evening. It was a very short evening, unfortunately.
Thank you for
too short.
Us. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having
you.
Us.
Thank you.
Short, yeah, just thanks again. The show was produced by Roberta Rael and Melissa Harris, so thanks to them.
Also, we want to thank Comaria Umi, our engineer for this evening, and Angel Alvarez, our music director.
We would also like to thank all of our youth makers here at Generation Justice. Without everybody there, we would be incomplete. And stay connected with us. Check out our website, generationjustice.org, where you can listen to all our past shows, including this one, see our music playlist, and watch our videos.
This show shall be podcast tomorrow for anyone who missed it. So if you want to share it on your Facebook pages so that we can have them listen, your lists, we'd appreciate that. And also our very short playlist of our three songs that we played this evening, you can find them on our website as well.
We're also active on social media. So
so you can find us there. And a few of us have been tweeting this evening, so look for those tweets.
Generation Justice is funded by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation with additional funding by the McCune Foundation.
And for those of you who remember, this is Pledge Drive Sunday. And if you like what we do here at KUNM and you appreciate what we do here at Generation Justice, we really encourage you to pledge tonight on the web. Go to KUNM.org and say that you like us.
I'm Omar Torres.
And I'm Roberta Rael, and it truly has been a pleasure to be able to sit in the room with all of you who care and love our community so deeply. Thank you for the amazing work that you do and the hard labors of love that you continue to do.
Yes, and thank you for educating our community about what's really going on, because a lot of people don't know, and those who know always need to learn more about it. So thanks again.
We've got some more music coming up, and then next up is Spoken Word.
You're fighting the case. There's cops like this everywhere, so how are we safe? We need to stand up, cause they're out of control. With police like this, we have to revolt. We cannot sit down, we cannot let go. We cannot pretend we haven't seen what they've shown. We need to stand up, cause they're out of control. With police like this, we have to revolt. We cannot sit down, we cannot let go. We cannot pretend we haven't seen what they've shown. Every tax.
Puerta de entrada siempre tuvo el cartel que dijo que estaba cerrada. Una espina clavada, una herida infectada, entramada, una rabia colmada en el todo y en la nada. El paso torpe, el borde sin acorde, cada vez que pierdo el norte tengo la pérdida del soporte. El tiempo que clava, me traba, la daga me mata, filuda la flama sin calma que de las manos se me escapa, pero...